When the disciples were in Jerusalem after Easter, Jesus would appear, but never for long, to the women. He appeared in the garden. He appeared to the two on the journey from Emmaus. He appeared to the disciples behind locked doors twice, a week apart the second time when Thomas had joined them, never long, as if he was winning them away. But now they had left Jerusalem because he had sent them home, sent them north back to Galilee. And although their minds were still trying to make sense of all that had happened, I suspect for one of them there were also prolonged periods of introspection and silence. For although Peter had now seen Jesus by himself and twice with the disciples, he was still haunted by his failure. He was disappointed at how he had responded to the test. And no doubt inside he felt, maybe I should just give up. And then they were back in familiar territory, back at the Sea of Tiberias or the Sea of Galilee, where Peter and others had been successful fishermen with their own boats and their own men to help them doing this. Maybe he should just park that disciple part of his life. Maybe he should take up his old life. And so, in a sense, frustrated by his failure, he said, I'm going fishing. And to his surprise, six of the others, led by Thomas, said, we're with you. Maybe they just didn't want him to be on his own. Maybe Peter was saying, well, I need some time to relax, to get away from all these events. Or maybe he just wanted to rebel and do something different. And out they went, and you can imagine the adrenaline as they did things which they hadn't done for a while. No doubt muscles began to get a bit stiff, but the adrenaline began to flow as they went out into familiar waters and they cast their nets. But then they caught nothing, and hour after hour it's pretty monotonous if you don't catch anything and you're out there all night. And as they came to dawn and it was time to pack up the nets and sail home, I wonder if Peter, looking at the empty net, saw them as a metaphor for his life. Empty. Useless. And then when they were still about 100 yards off, there was a figure, hard to see because the sun was still just beginning to rise. It was still that kind of twilight moment. And a voice came across the word, children, do you have any fish? Not the thing you ask fishermen when their boats are empty. Word to the wise, spoiler, don't do it. And yet there was something about the words and the way they were spoken that, at least perhaps for some of them, remembered an event 3 years earlier when someone had encouraged them to do their fishing differently. And when they had, the nets were full to breaking. Cast your nets on the right side of the boat. That was quite a big ask for a non-fisherman of a fisherman. And I wondered if any of them thought, well, we'll do it just to please him, and then we'll have a few direct words when we get back to the shore. But all that was forgotten as the nets met resistance. And suddenly, there was an excitement, and the waters were teeming, and they pulled the fish. They counted them. Fishermen do that. Don't ever ask a fisherman, how did you get on? They'll tell you till you are yawning with exhaustion. 153 fish. What's 154? 153 fish. We'll settle for that. And as most of them are thinking about the fish and what that will bring at the market, John it was. John, who had lain on Jesus' breast in that Last Supper. John, who, unlike any of the others, had stayed at the foot of the cross with the mother of Jesus. Suddenly realized why the voice was familiar and the miracle also. It is the Lord. And if he was the one who understood what was going on, it was Peter who did something very impulsive, but not totally impulsive. He put his clothes on before he went into the water, which is not a good idea. But maybe he was thinking as he swam, I wish I could still walk in water. That would have kept my clothes dry. And there he is. He's heading back to the shore. And there he is. He's ahead of the rest. And there's Jesus, the person he wants to be with most of all. And yet there's this huge barrier. And there's Jesus, and he's already cooking fish and got bread ready, and there's a fire burning. And if Peter was slightly self-conscious, Jesus said, look, the others are doing all the hard work. Just go back and help them. And then bring some of your fish. And they all sat round slightly uncomfortably when Jesus started to serve out breakfast. They knew it was the Lord, but you don't often have someone who's been dead serving you breakfast. But of course, it wasn't fish he was serving. It was forgiveness. God lets disappointments come into our life. And sometimes we get very discouraged. From the show of hands, I didn't ask the three who came late whether they also made mistakes, but the rest of the church did. So if you're not like that, don't worry. But it's universal. We get it wrong. And it's recurring. We get it wrong again and again. And here's the worst thing about discouragement. It's highly contagious. If you're down in the dumps, you can sure infect other people pretty quickly. And I wonder if this story is telling us at this point, listen, when life goes pear-shaped, don't give up. Don't feel because you've got it wrong or you feel that God's got it wrong that now's your turn to turn your back on this whole Christian thing. And perhaps we need to learn what the fishermen learned that night. What Jesus said, one sense, without me, you will do nothing. And that was too true for them, despite their experience as fishermen. And perhaps they learned also that when Jesus tells us to do anything, however strange it might seem, obedience is always the right response. You see, even when we've done things badly, drifted away, Jesus loves us, and he loves you just the way you are, but he loves you too much to let you stay that way. And he wants to bring them back and take them forward. Here's the strange thing about this story, that the blessing they were received was far closer than they could possibly think. The only difference between an empty net and a bulging net was the width of the boat. And I don't know whether it was a bigger miracle that Jesus kept the fish away all night because it was a well-stocked lake, or whether he brought them just at the right moment when they threw their nets were over. But their instinct was right that when Jesus spoke again in their emptiness, there was no hesitation, no procrastination. They wanted to go and get and be with him. Do you remember the first time they did that miracle in Luke chapter 5? Peter had said, "Depart from me, Lord, I am a sinful man." This time he wanted to get to Jesus. When he had walked in the water during the night, he'd asked, "Are you really Jesus?" Doesn't need to do that this time. He knows who it is. And nothing will stop Peter from getting to the Savior. And what I love is that although Jesus had a tasty breakfast ready, he says, "Peter, go on, let's add to it. Let's add to it some of your fish to my fish." Isn't that lovely? Everything that happens to us is of grace. It's all of God. But God delights when we share what we have to what he wants to bring to us. There'd be no crowing from the disciples. They knew it was the stranger who had filled their nets, but they were still being asked to make breakfast a memorable meal. Of course, the story unfolds, and the focus is not on the fish, but on the fishermen. And the lovely thing is that though Jesus has to talk with them, he knows that first of all they are tired and cold and hungry. And a wee seat around the coal fire and a few bits of fish and bread in your mouth perk you up no end and get them back in an even keel. although I don't think the conversation flowed very easily, because in between their chewing the fish, their jaw was dropping, which doesn't make for a pleasant sight if you're a bunch of men. But God's grace was there. And now Jesus has to speak. I've no idea whether, and I've imagined it both ways, whether Jesus said to Peter, come on, and they walked along the shore together and had a private conversation, or whether Jesus wanted to speak to Peter in front of all the others, in case, knowing what Peter done, the others had kind of felt that he'd let down Jesus worse than they had. And so it was a public restoration. There's two sermons there. Anyone's a commissioner, you've got two different sermons, change it ever over the years. And then Jesus speaks, and he calls Peter by his name, but not his special name, his old name. Simon, son of John. The name means a reed, easily blown in the wind, moves when the tide moves. Not Peter, the rock. And as he says, Simon, son of John, you could almost imagine Peter catching his breath and just wondering what's going to come next. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he's thinking, what's he talking about? Well, he's still got a plate of fish. So do I love you more than breakfast? Well, yeah, normally, except when I'm hungry. Or did he look out and see the boats and think, do you love me more than that old life of fishing that was your raison d'etre? And then it twigged. He was thinking of how he had boasted in front of all the other disciples. Oh, I'll lay my life down for you. If everyone else falls away, I'm your man. But that morning, instead of bragging, he was broken. Do you love me unconditionally, unreservedly? Do you think you're better than the rest of them sitting around here having their seconds of fish and bread? The interesting thing is, Jesus said, do you truly love me? And Peter could only say, I'm fond of you. So Jesus asked him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? And Peter's day of boasting is past. I'm very fond of you. So the third time, and of course three times, three failures, around a coal fire, which is only mentioned once in the Gospels in the high priest's courtyard, which was where Peter fell. Simon, son of John, Jesus changes his question. Simon, son of John, are you fond of me? And maybe Peter both was humbled that Jesus would come to his level and hurt that his profession of being fond of Jesus wasn't accepted as true or questioned. Lord, you know everything. You know that I'm fond of you. I wonder if that was your story, if someone very close to you had let you down so badly, what your default response would have been. You could, of course, have met them with silence. Or you could have used anger. Or you could have brought up his failure at Embry Cotton. Perhaps not Peter. We can't really rely on him. Or just marginalized him. And if there are other subtle or not so subtle ways, you probably know them better than me. Because we do that to people when they let us down. And that's not what Jesus ever does for us when we let him down. Can I just say that as a church, we face an uncertain future, as do many churches. In terms of our congregation, in terms of our presbytery plan. And the way we respond in the next months and years are nothing to do with the presbytery or the congregation, and everything to do with Jesus. Because we are here because we follow Jesus, no matter what. And he will pick us up and keep us following, no matter what. So let me try and bring this together. Because there are three things in the end of this conversation that are a call to you and a call to me as I, with Ruth, step into a new chapter in my life. And it is this, that we are called to love lavishly. I find it fascinating that when they had that conversation, Jesus could easily have given Peter the third degree, cross-examined him. Jesus could have told a parable that would have made the point, as so often it did. Or he could have taught them how we cope with failure and forgiveness. And instead, all he wants to know is, where's your love level just now? Where's your love for me at this point? You know that in Greek, there are a number of different words for love. One is eros, from which we get erotic. That's not used. The word that Jesus used is a selfless, sacrificial love, agape. And the word that that Peter responds to is phileo. It's a friendship love. Jesus' love knows no limits. Friendship love's great. But he calls for something deeper. He wants a servant-hearted love. It was Peter's pride that was behind his fall from grace. Peter was so sure that he could stand any test. But then David never thought he would commit adultery or murder, and Solomon never thought that he'd end up having lots of idols in his temple, and Moses had no plans to kill anyone, and Jonah never thought he'd run away, and Peter never thought he'd deny the Lord. So if you are standing firm, Paul will write, be careful that you don't fall. Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. And Jesus had seen the tears that had poured down the cheeks and the shoulders that had shaken with a sense of desolation that at the time of testing, he had failed. Lord, I'm not there yet. But with your strength, perhaps I could get there. Love lavishly. Secondly, serve selflessly. You see, it's all very well to proclaim your love for God or your love for Jesus, and it's always the first thing. But unless that translates into a love for other people in practical service, what does it all count for? One of the challenges we face as a congregation when I go off to my care home in Peebles or wherever I'm going is that there'll be all sorts of tasks that Ruth and I have done that people will need to pick up. And it will only happen if we all pick it up and all do it together. Because we serve selflessly. Why? Not because we care for Palmer's Place, but we care that people who come into this church or when we go out into this parish will discover the love of God that has changed our lives, will know the forgiveness that has set us free and the sense of purpose that has given us direction. And so for that sake, we will serve selflessly because we love lavishly. That's why Jesus, after saying, "Do you love me?" says, "Feed my sheep. Take care of my lambs. Look after them." The lambs and the sheep, they're quite different. I can't tell you which is harder. But they're both challenging. And if someone in the congregation is driving you mad, just say, well, they could be a goat. Or an old goat. But they're a sheep. And they're Jesus' sheep. And we'll look after them. And if they get things wrong, we just high-five them and say, hey, I did the same. Join the club. And then the last thing of all, love lavishly and serve selflessly and follow faithfully. I don't know what your life story will look like over the next 10, 20, 40, 60 years. Neither do you. But I know this, that Jesus calls on us to keep close to him and to follow him and to believe that through the dark days he is the light, and through the painful days he is our comfort, and through the confusing days it will one day all make sense. Peter, you've chosen throughout your life what you do. One day someone will take you and they will stretch out your hands where you do not want to go. For he, like his master, would die on a cross, though being Peter to an end, he said, excuse me, can you put me upside down? I don't feel worthy of being like Jesus. Even to the end, he's trying to control it. And then he says, and what's going to happen to John? And Jesus says very politely, mind your own business. Everyone has a different story with different chapters. But there is nothing more exciting and nothing more fulfilling than to follow Jesus. I little realized when I was 11 years old at a Scripture Union holiday when I tentatively and undramatically said, I want to follow Jesus, the life that would unfold over the next 50 years. But I would have no other life, and so grateful to God for that. And for you, and for us. We come to the second last of our studies in Beyond the Tomb. Let's go from this place knowing forgiveness where we have got it wrong and hope where we are called to live it. Now, the sun is risen. They've had their breakfast. It's dawn and it's light. And Jesus and Peter are best buddies again. High five to that.